You're listening to Everybody Pulls the Tarp, the go-to podcast for high performers. I'm Andrew Moses. Each week, you'll hear my thought-provoking conversations with Olympians, pro athletes, CEOs, elite coaches, best-selling authors, and other high performers to uncover their secrets to success. Get ready to be inspired each week when we talk about leadership, teamwork, work ethic, and more. Are you ready? Let's go. Hey, everyone. Well, it has been a remarkable few years for women's sports. Back in 2022, the U.S. women's national soccer team secured its long-awaited equal pay agreement. And in 2023, we witnessed record-setting attendance and investment in women's sports. For example, the Women's College World Series shattered attendance records. And in volleyball, more than 92,000 fans poured into Memorial Stadium in Lincoln, Nebraska, for the Nebraska versus Omaha volleyball match, setting a new world record for attendees at a women's sporting event. And in another example, Sixth Street Capital made the largest institutional investment in history at the time in a women's pro sports franchise to launch new NWSL team Bay FC, which we've already talked about a lot here on the podcast on previous episodes with Bay FC founding members and co-owners Leslie Osborne and Allie Wagner. Now here in 2024, the momentum continues. So far in 2024, Bay FC sold out its inaugural match. Jenny Kavnar became the first female to be a primary play-by-play announcer in Major League Baseball history. And 19,285 fans packed Toronto's Scotiabank Arena in February to set the women's hockey attendance record. And then a crowd of more than 21,000 broke the record again just over 2 months later at Bell Center in Montreal on April 20th. And of course, during March Madness, the women's tournament was the talk of the town, culminating in a women's national championship game between Iowa and University of South Carolina that had higher viewership than the men's final for the first time in history. Well, I could literally go on and on because women's sports are making history everywhere you turn. But here's something I've noticed. So many people are referring to all of this as a moment. But the word I've been using instead is a movement. Because what we're seeing in women's sports today is truly the result of a decades-long movement by countless female trailblazers in sports who paved the way, including many that we've heard from on this podcast over the past few years. And this week, my guest is another one of those trailblazers that's been part of this remarkable movement over the past few decades. Her name is Shannon Higgins-Sarofsky. Shannon was a star midfielder for the U.S. women's national soccer team in the 1980s and early 90s. And she played a pivotal role in the team's championship run at the first ever Women's World Cup in 1991. In 2002, she was inducted into the National Soccer Hall of Fame, at the time becoming just the third woman to be bestowed that honor. Shannon was also named to Soccer America's Team of the Century as one of the top 11 players to have impacted women's soccer in the 20th century. Along the way, Shannon also had a storied collegiate coaching career and is a two-time ACC Coach of the Year. Well, Shannon and I recently caught up to explore her trailblazing journey and the success secrets that have powered her extraordinary career. Our conversation is jam-packed with so many ideas that everyone needs to hear. This was a really enjoyable conversation, and it's filled with lessons that all of us can apply to our own lives, personally and professionally. So, let's pull the tarp and get straight to soccer legend Shannon Higgins-Sarofsky. Shannon, it's great to have you. I have had the good fortune of talking to so many U.S. women's national team legends over the years, and every single one of the conversations leaves me with incredible lessons, remarkable insight, and so much inspiration. I can't wait to dig into your story as well. Where I want to begin, I want to go way back. So you first joined the U.S. women's national team in 1987. It wasn't even established until 1985, which is almost remarkable to think about. I'm curious, what do you remember most about the experience at that first World Cup and in many ways the lead up to that first World Cup? What do you remember most? What was it like? Take me back in time a bit.
Oh boy, you're going to challenge me here. The things that I remember the most were primarily the camps and all of the hard work that we were putting in each time we came together. I mean, we all had other jobs. We all came together for short periods of time in order to train for these kind of like, I guess, traveling trips where, you know, we didn't know what we were even going towards because at that point we didn't even know there was a world championship. I remember just all the little things that about the countries that we visited in China where there was no refrigeration, sleeping on a coal train, going across the country, you know, with the windows wide open. I remember flying on aircraft. I'm sorry about my dog. Flying on aircraft that I just can't believe I got on because they were just frightening. I remember a lot of just kind of the hardships of the travel, the hardships of the, you know, trying to make it financially. You'd save up all your per diem that you got $10 a day while you were traveling. And that was it. That was all of our income we had. And so we'd save it up because you needed to go home and you needed to live. And at the time, you know, in those preparation years, I was the last couple of preparation years anyway, I was at George Washington University coaching. And I literally was making like $10,000 a year. And, you know, I had to do clinic work and, you know, in order to get by, I had to do all this youth clinic work. And yeah, it was a struggle, but I wouldn't change it for the world.
I can totally appreciate that, Shannon. And now at that point, and a lot of people today probably can't even comprehend that at that point, it really wasn't a foregone conclusion that the U.S. women's national team was going to be this global powerhouse that it would ultimately become, even though you had yourself included, even though you had so many talented players in these camps. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, when you're coming together for short periods of time, like you described, how do you build that camaraderie and that culture that ultimately puts any group on a winning path?
You know, I think that's one of the great things that Anson did over the years is that, you know, we had a pretty consistent roster from late 87, probably to 91. And cruel as that may seem, you know, in this day and age with injury and all the talent, but we really did have a core that kind of moved forward. And each and every camp, I mean, those who suffer together as far as the fitness and the, you know, always tend to grow together. And we were tough. I mean, we were a tough bunch. I mean, nothing had ever been given to us. And we were scraping and crawling for everything that we'd ever had. And we were incredibly grateful for any experience that we had as females, because most of us grew up playing with boys. And our dream was to play in a World Cup war. And we just didn't ever think it would be a reality. And when it was, you know, in front of us, I mean, that in itself, having that common goal to not only play, but also be the best was truly something that brought us together.
You mentioned Anson Dorrance there, the legendary coach, arguably the greatest college soccer coach on the face of the earth. If you look at the stats over a long, long period of time, I'm curious, what is it that in your mind has made Anson Dorrance so successful as a coach?
Well, I think, you know, especially he's incredibly articulate. He's a fascinating person just to sit around and listen to his latest philosophy on this or on that. But he articulates very well. He showed a respect for the athletes, but he also challenges you. I remember, perfect example, I was playing for him collegiately, and I was the leading goal scorer on the team from midfield, the leading assister on the team, and by far. And I was doing well. I was getting some recognition, et cetera. And he brought me in and he said, hey, listen, it's not good enough. You need to not only serve that ball, you need to get on the end of the cross as well. And did it make me mad. But at the same time, it challenged me. And, you know, the next year, that's what I was doing. I was not only assisting goals, I was also scoring goals. He challenges people. He gives you ultimate respect and he gives you the environment to grow.
And if I'm not mistaken, shortly before he became the coach at University of North Carolina, he was set to become an attorney. Is that correct?
He was. He was very just shy of becoming an attorney and decided that that's not what he wanted to do. When I first arrived to Carolina, he was actually coaching the men and the women, probably in order to make ends meet. And then it was after my freshman year that he slid over to females only.
What was it in particular, if we double click a little further into that idea of challenging you, and not only challenging you, but challenging so many athletes over the years, both on the field and off of it, what is it, whether it's Anson Dorrance or just another great leader, or even when you think about your experience as a coach during that phase of your career, what is it about certain leaders that make them able to find that right balance of not pushing someone too hard, but pushing them just the right amount to help them stretch their boundaries a little bit?
I think the biggest thing is that that coach lets them know how much they care about them. And once you know that that person cares about you, you know that they can challenge you in ways that, because they believe in you. And I think that that's the common thread, is like you can give them a hug, but can also kick them in the rear end. And once you've established that relationship, that's when you get the best out of people.
In 1991, at that World Championship, and eventually went on to be called the Women's World Cup, as we know it today, you were a key member of that roster. You played through a stress fracture in your foot. You helped set up that first goal in the championship game that Michelle Akers ultimately scored. I'm curious, playing with a broken foot, stress fracture, was that level of toughness, was that something that's always been part of your game and part of the equation for you?
Yeah, I grew up with two brothers, so I was tortured most of the time. Yeah, I don't know how to quit. I mean, it's funny, I probably had a connection to you through a workout class that I go to all the time. Mo had referred me to you. And I just don't, even now, know how to half-ass it. I just don't. It's just part of who I am, and can't let it go.
Have you thought about where that comes from? Like, is it?
My mom said from the day I came out, I was just one of those kids who just, I was very, very intense. Let's put it that way.
Very, very intense.
You know, teams in my house. Let's put it that way.
Well, as I mentioned, I've talked to so many U.S. women's national team legends and so many high performers across all different disciplines. But one of the things I remember most about the conversations with folks like you and who were part of the U.S. women's national team ecosystem is something that, you know, I remember Christy Pierce Rampone telling me, and I've heard from others as well, that the practices for the U.S. women's national team were in many ways, for many, many years, often harder than the games. And she said, you know, I don't mean that in disrespect to the opponents that we played. What I was trying to communicate to you, Andrew, she said, is the fact that, like, what a cauldron of competition it is, whether it's at the U.S. women's national team camps. And I can only imagine that your toughness and that intensity that you have enabled you to get through some challenging environments as part of those camps and that whole ecosystem.
Oh, for sure. The practices were brutal, not only as far as, you know, the physicality, because every time you go up another level in the game, the physicality goes up. In addition to that, you know, the fitness tests that you had, they just put you on your edge, you know, the point where you're losing bodily functions and things of that nature. It literally was just a part of, it was not a natural thing that you just absolutely killed yourself. And then after that, you went off the field and you iced up and slept a little bit and went back out. I remember coming out of camp, we had a 1v1 camp one year. I don't know what his obsession, Anson's obsession was with it, but I mean, literally I had bruises up and down my knees from sliding on the grass, and I couldn't move after the whole camp was over, but made the team had a few days to rest.
Yeah. Made the team and a few days to rest. We talked about the intensity that you've always had. Your mother said you essentially came out intense and ready to work hard at whatever you were going to put your mind to. But I'm always curious to ask people how they found the craft that they ultimately ended up really excelling in. And I've told this story on the podcast before. Listeners will be familiar with it for those folks who've been listening to it a while. But Christine Lilly, your teammate in 1991, told me this amazing story that I've just never forgotten. She said, Andrew, the reason I got into soccer in the first place was because of the orange slices at halftime. And she went on to explain, it ended up being more profound than just the orange slices. She said, Andrew, she talked about this idea that she really got into soccer because she loved the orange slices at halftime and she liked spending time with her friends. And she would remind herself of that no matter how big the stage or how high the pressure got, no matter the circumstances, that she got into this game because she loved it and because it was fun. And I always enjoy asking high performers who excel at a craft, how did you discover soccer in the first place and what drew you to the beautiful game?
Oh boy. So probably what drew me to soccer is because I absolutely adored my brothers. And my older brother was doing it. And he taught me how to dribble one day in the backyard. And so I signed up for a team and I was good. And you're going to get addicted to things that are that you're good at. But in addition to that, you know, I think there was. I mean, I just remember how much fun every game was at that youth level, and especially the really young levels. And like I said, the snacks afterwards, they were great. Not even at halftime, it was the snacks afterwards, the sweet stuff that came. That was great. You know, and you'd go after the game and you'd be all scummed out in your uniform and you'd go to eat someplace or go to some festival someplace. You know, it's always something to do with your friends after the game because you came together to play and then it was seemed kind of festive afterwards.
There's a lot that I want to dive deeper that you shared there, Shannon. First, you were good at it. You talked about being good at it right from the jump. And I'm curious, when was the first time that you felt some resistance where you felt maybe, now this is a little harder for me than it was. Like, what do you remember that first time when you felt like, hey, this is a little harder than I remember and I'm going to have to challenge myself to grow? When was that moment and how did you respond?
You know, this might not have been my first one, but this sticks out in my mind as being a time when I finally decided that I was going to give this a go. I was in college at Carolina. I was a freshman. And we were playing against Michelle Akers' team, UCF. First, this was the opening game of my freshman year. And I'm playing with all these incredibly talented players. And I was not starting. And I got out on the field and got absolutely hammered to the ground the second I got out there. And I remember I was crying and they actually took me off the field. And as they're taking me off the field, I was thinking to myself, maybe I'm not that good. Maybe this is not my thing. Maybe I need to quit. And I went on that year. I started that year and I was a, you know, a three-time national player of the year. But that was that moment when I realized that I hadn't done enough yet. I had not put in the work in the weight room. I was maybe not doing enough on the, as far as making myself the best athlete I could be. I was a pretty good soccer player, but I wasn't a great athlete and I hadn't invested, so to speak.
So what did you do from there? How did you invest?
You know, I obviously indulged in every practice, but I remember the off season came and I started running like 8 to 10 miles, like 6 days a week in addition to practice. Insane stuff that I probably shouldn't have been doing, but I needed to catch up in that regard. And remember, I started taking the weight rooms more seriously because, you know, at the time I didn't weigh nearly as much as I should have. And I wasn't nearly as strong as I needed to be in order to take those tackles that obviously hurt really bad once. And I need to be able to dish it out a little bit too.
Is Michelle the best player that you ever went up against? Like, who's the best player? Is it Michelle or somebody else? Who's the best player you ever played against?
You know, I would probably say Michelle. But, you know, the funny thing is that it's the beauty of team is that there's always somebody that does something that you just admire so much because you bring something to the team. I brought vision and technical ability and all this stuff. And Michelle Akers brought a physicality and a heading ability and things of that nature. And everybody on the team had this little something they were just was really special about them that just, you know, almost were in awe of. I mean, Mia Hamm's acceleration, oh my gosh. Absolutely. I mean, just she was there and then she wasn't. That's the beauty of it. I mean, I would say overall, in an overarching gives everything to the game, I would say Michelle Akers.
You talked about some of your strengths there. I mean, such a creative playmaker on the field, midfielder. What drew you to the midfield? And I guess how quickly did you identify what your one thing or couple of things was going to be that you were going to contribute?
Well, about the time I realized I wasn't very fast, that's when I kind of squirmed into the midfield where I wasn't exposed, especially in the center. And I always had vision. From the literally when I was 9 years old, people were talking about my vision, my ability to see a pass before it, you know, it developed, that kind of thing. And so I tried to cultivate that. And if you're going to have to get rid of the ball quickly because you're not overly fast, you're going to have to be able to know where everything is. And you're going to have a, you know, an incredible technical ability. And so I focused on those things and tried to be as good as I could at some of those other things.
Let's talk about that for a little bit. Like one of the things that I always kind of wrestle with is how do you balance? Like what's the right formula between really building upon your strengths and really trying to mitigate your weaknesses? And I guess, how did you think about that as a player? And then how did you communicate ideas like that idea to players that you coached when you went on to obviously coach at GW and then at Maryland?
Well, obviously you can't ignore your weaknesses. And so you have to put in, I remember I used to get depressed as a player whenever we were doing the things at practice that I absolutely stunk at. And noticing that that actually hurt me was the next step in helping me assess it and kind of tackle it and go at it. And so I think as a coach, when I moved forward, I was always talking to players, okay, well, what do you think your strengths are? What do you think your weaknesses are? Well, how do we move forward from here in order to make it so that you're confident with these things and it doesn't become your downfall, but at the same time, highlight what's incredibly special about you. So I was always communicative with players in regards, and probably brutally honest in regards to what they brought and what they didn't bring. And because we were always that way. I mean, people would laugh at me at practice when we did the speed ladder because I lost to half the goalkeepers.
Wow.
And so learning to kind of deal with the fact that, okay, I have these shortcomings, but I need to make certain they're not that big a shortcoming. Ways to mitigate that.
It's so interesting how you describe that moment where you came to the realization that, like, how working on skills or areas of the game that you weren't that good at was weighing you down more globally as a player. How did you shift the mindset? How did you make sure that you didn't let some of the negative stuff permeate your game in more totality?
I think I'm just stubborn more than anything else. I had a strong desire to be the best. I was intense. And so I knew that I had to kind of go forward the goal. I mean, it took me a while to kind of sit down and get rid of the emotion and untie the emotion from the actual process. But then my tenacity and kind of that grittiness of myself helped me be that. I mean, I didn't believe in acting any different when we were playing, you know, Elon University than when we were playing for the national title. I didn't believe in that. It wasn't who I was. And so I think that led to some of that just naturally made it so that I moved past those moments.
That is a very common theme that comes up in a lot of the conversations that I have, whether it's with elite athletes, elite musicians, coaches. A musician will say, I really don't approach the performance differently if I'm playing at a major arena or stadium versus a small nightclub that I would play in the early days, right? You, when you're a competitor and you bring that intensity, it doesn't matter. You bring the best to your craft at all times. And I think that's, people ask me all the time for through lines through all these conversations. And I think that's one of the through lines that continues to pop up. You talk about playing for a national championship. Let's talk about playing for a world championship. You talked about a lot of the conditions and the per diems and the flights and all these different things leading up to 1991. But what do you remember most about winning that world championship, eventually become the name the World Cup as we know it today in 1991? And did you envision how intense and how much growth and energy there was going to be between 91 and 99, which a lot of people, you know, if you just ask like a casual sports fan or just any American, right? That's a moment that many people can kind of point to, that proverbial, I remember where I was then when Brandi Chastain hit that penalty kick. But in many ways, that wasn't a moment. That was the start of a movement, and a movement that we're still seeing, we're seeing manifest itself in remarkable, remarkable ways today, not just in soccer, but in women's sports in general. I'm curious, take me through like winning that championship in 1991, and then could you have envisioned what would happen as quickly as 99?
I couldn't envision any of that. And it was so amazing to watch it happen. By the time 99 came around, I had already had two kids. I wasn't going to hop back out there on the field, but I couldn't envision it. I mean, we had obviously large crowds out in China, and I think that we were entertaining. We had some pretty large crowds when we were in Haiti for the qualifiers, but we came home to nothing. I mean, we walked off the airplane, and I remember the president of the federation was there with a couple of gurus from U.S. soccer. And people knew we won, but it wasn't, you know, they weren't at the airport. It was kind of, you came home, you went, oh, well, we won a World Cup. And no, almost nobody knew about it except the diehard soccer fans. So no, I couldn't have envisioned where it went. It's amazing to see what these athletes are doing and how much they have.
As I mentioned moments ago, I mean, we're kind of in a way at this watershed moment in women's sports. I mean, when you just think about over the past couple of years, right, the equal pay in women's soccer, all the investment in the NWSL. I recently had conversations on this podcast with Ali Wagner and Leslie Osborne, who got a record-setting commitment from a venture capital firm to build Bay FC. It's a record-setting institutional investment in a women's sports franchise, the largest investment at that point. And we're just coming off, we're recording this now just days after the women's basketball and the March Madness, which was absolutely incredible. And a lot of people will point to Caitlin Clark and some of the personalities in women's basketball today, and they'll talk about this as if it's an overnight success. And whether it's success in anything, when people describe it as an overnight success, it like makes me cringe, because there is no such thing as overnight success. And I'll use that phrase I used a few minutes ago, that it's not a moment, it's a movement, that it's been a movement for so long. Women's sports in general, women's soccer. Have you spent any time the last couple of years reflecting on the role that you had in it?
You know, it's funny, I don't reflect upon it in that regard. It's an interesting concept. When I think about, I guess I think back on it with women's soccer, but I don't see it globally across other sports. And I think that sports, women's sports have influenced each other. They've been, I guess I haven't thought about it that way. But yeah, I think that, you know, there's, and that's my small little mountain of a world. Perhaps some little inkling of thought.
Well, I think any great movement over a long period of time is really the aggregation of a lot of little micro interactions. And there's no question that you have a massive part in it. And I've been thinking more and more lately about this idea of how different things that are adjacent to one another actually really support the growth of everything. You know, and I'm going to use an example now outside of sports. I've interviewed many, many best-selling authors. And one of the through lines in a lot of the conversations I've had with authors that I think can be applied to business, sports, and a lot of different things is this remarkable community that authors build with each other. And I remember asking a couple authors, aren't you competitors? Like, I see you all on social media promoting each other's books, attending each other's book signings, doing events together. And the response is something I'll never forget. The response that one of the authors gave me was, she said, Andrew, we're helping grow a genre. And these authors in particular write historical fiction. She said, because, you know, in the traditional sense, when people used to go to bookstores to get their books before they, you know, went to Amazon or wherever, when they came to a section in a bookstore and they grabbed one author's books, whose books do you think in that genre were right near that author's books? It was my books and her books and his books. And they might stumble across my book as well. So I always believed that the best formula was to lift everybody up, lift the genre, lift the category. I think there's been a lot of that to women's sports. And I know you just alluded to the fact that you didn't necessarily think about it that way. But I do think that a lot of these different sports and a lot of these different personalities from different generations have really supported one another, whether they realize it or not.
Oh, for sure. By just seeing and becoming, you know, you become friends with people who have similar and like experiences. And, you know, whether it's a basketball or soccer or whatever sport it is, you're always going to have, you know, a similarity as far as a commitment to something that you're passionate about. And I think that, I forget where I was going with this.
Well, this has been just a wonderful, wonderful conversation. One of the questions I like to ask almost everybody that I encounter is, if you had to distill your success down to one thing, what would you say it is? Is it that intensity that we talked about? Is that commitment, regardless of the circumstances? Like, what would be your one thing?
It's definitely the intensity. I just built for never giving up, you know, and I just, at least physically.
And just to continue that thought as we get ready to wrap up our conversation, what's something that you worried about a ton as it pertains to your career early on that you wish that you hadn't spent so much time worrying about?
Failure. I was just so afraid to fail. And I didn't understand how powerful that could be in my development as not only an athlete, but also as a person. And putting yourself out there. So definitely it would be a fear of failure.
Fear of failure. It's something that plagues a lot of people. I know there's a lot of listeners out there who are going to take a lot of inspiration and a lot of powerful ideas from all the wisdom that you shared, Shannon. I just think back to that moment that you were on that field against Michelle Akers and you thought you weren't good enough. And as you said, you invested. You doubled down on your strengths and you worked to mitigate weaknesses. And you went on to become a World Cup champion, a National Soccer Hall of Fame inductee, which you were inducted in 2002, only the third woman at the time to be inducted into the National Soccer Hall of Fame, and a four-time national champion at UNC, a two-time ACC Coach of the Year once he went on to coaching. Remarkable, remarkable journey. I'm just so grateful for the time that we've gotten to spend together. I hope that this is the first of many conversations because I know I've learned a ton from you and I could ask you questions for hours and hours and hours. But thank you so much for spending a few minutes with me this week. All right, Shannon?
All right. Thank you, Andrew.
All right, everyone. If you loved this episode, you might also enjoy my interviews with other trailblazing women in sports, including Christine Lilly, Allie Krieger, Tessa Virtue, Tara Lipinski, Heather O'Reilly, Melanie Newman, Jennifer Azey, and many more. They're all right here on Everybody Pulls the Tarp in your favorite podcast app. Each of these episodes are filled with inspiration and powerful lessons that you don't want to miss. Check them out and let me know what you think. Thank you for joining me this week. Be sure to subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you can catch all of our upcoming episodes. And if you are like me and want a world full of tarp pullers, then leave a review to help others find us. You can also follow me on Twitter at Andrew H. Moses. That's Andrew H. Moses. And be sure to sign up for my email newsletter at everybodypullsthetarp.com/newsletter. I'll share tips and insights to help you achieve maximum success and happiness. Today is a great day to pull the tarp. I am rooting for you. See you next time.